Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, because everybody now has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Dr. or Professor, something of that nature, Victor H. Fisher. Welcome to the program.
Well, hello. How are you this fine day?
I'm really quite lovely, especially now that you're here.
Really quite lovely, huh?
Yeah, I don't really feel quite this way very often, but yes.
How about that? Well, it's usually lovely is not masculine, but that's okay. If you feel lovely,
don't worry.
I feel healthy, so that makes us both in good shape.
That's good, because I don't usually feel masculine either. Speaking of which, you're a bit of a brain expert and an inventor and such, and you know so much about how the brain works and the chemistry and the thinking process and all of that sort of thing. I was wondering, just in all your years, Victor, what are some of the most important lessons that you've learned about just life in general through studying the brain?
Well, when you know how the brain is works, it makes life a lot much more pleasant. My frustrations are minimized. We'll put it that way. Because I know when before I did my research, I was constantly bombarded with frustrations that I couldn't understand why other people didn't think like I did.
And yeah, well,
some of my bosses. So
that can always be a real harsh one, working underneath people who are beneath you.
Well, fortunately, that's one of the interesting aspects about organizational setups is that usually the most incompetent are the highest level, and therefore I was always blessed because in a normal setup my bosses were always given the opportunity to select their people to work with, and they were usually, in fact, I think in almost all cases, we had a good rapport. and it was just their bosses were the big problems of my I had. So then I had to select out other channels to bypass them, and in most cases I was successful in that area.
Is there some kind of a brain chemical thing that makes people desire to be incompetent and in power at the same time?
Well, it's not really a chemical. It's an actual built-in hardware. The person that is most incompetent knows that he is or she is. And therefore, they're very defensive, and the best defense is a strong offense, and so they push to climb the ladder of an organization. They learn how the politics of corporations, and so they push very hard to climb that ladder. A person that is competent is usually self-employed, so to speak, to handle the conflicts at his level. If he's a design engineer, to be a good design engineer and not really worry about corporate politics.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't quite understand exactly how that really affects their behavior.
See, the point I'm trying to make is that in my research, I was able to see there is a difference in the basic architecture of the human brain in the area of anticipation, and so what I did is I designated these primary differences as being prospective or retrospective, and that is a built-in hardware resource architecture, I should say. And so the retrospective individual knows basically day one that they need an external information source, whereas the prospective from day one they are self-motivated, and so they look out for they get joy out of conflicts, because that gives them an opportunity to show off, in a sense, or be successful and be happy in being able to solve conflicts, where the retrospective individual cannot handle conflicts because
I'm sure this phenomenon of the prospective and retrospective people have existed for a very, very long time in humanity. Are these people generally psychopathic in nature or something like that?
It depends. See, when you get into the psychopathic aspect or antisocial aspect, now you're getting into another extension or expansion of the divisions. And what I mean by that is that there is another element, which is the difference between being mentally motivated versus physically motivated. So if you are mentally motivated, that means that you will, in your solution of a conflict, you will respond to a conflict with a mental attitude. If you are physically motivated, you'll respond to that conflict on a physical basis. In other words, you'll strike out physically. At the beginning of our research, we used to call that an animalistic characteristic. whereas the mentally motivated would be more of a humanistic relationship. So if you have a person that is retrospective and is physically motivated, he is a psychopath.
Okay, so basically they're prone to gathering stuff. Like they're sort of like a magpie, if you will, for gathering power and wealth, influence, information, that kind of thing. They view the world as sort of a suction cup platform for which they can attach their parasitic selves and slurp all the life out, essentially.
That's right. That's right.
And the reason why they
of organizations, whether they're a club or a country, are usually physically motivated people, and their capability as far as retrospective versus prospective is relatively more on the retrospective side, because again, as I said, the retrospective side has a bias to try to cover up their incompetence, we'll put it that way.
So every time you say something, they go out of their mind for some reason and start viciously attacking you. And little do you know, they had somebody else say something very similar to them once in their life, and it was very, very true. And it really, really annoyed them. And now, you suffer the wrath.
The more retrospective. The problem with the retrospective is again, and the prospectives is we're talking only about anticipatory capability. A prospective is able to say that if A equals B and B equals C, that C equals A. In the case of a retrospective, A equals B and B equals C, and C doesn't equal A. And so it's just it's like having a patchboard plugged in backwards. And so the fortunate part or unfortunate part is that the brain as a system is actually broken up into different physical capabilities, but also what happens is that we have what has been termed as the conscious brain, conscious state of the brain, and then we have the subconscious state of the brain. Now, basically those can be easily modeled by saying, as compared to a computer, is that the conscious part of the brain is the short-term memory and the logic center for handling conflict situations, because there's many CPUs, at least 16 central processing systems in the human brain. But the two that are involved with the two that are involved with logic. That's a special CPU, and it is there's one for each hemisphere, and so what you have there is the capability of having a situation where the retrospective person can only operate from his memory, because he can. Every time he tries to analyze a solution to a conflict, he or she will not get a correct answer. But if he uses his subconscious memory, which is really the long-term memory, that is almost always correct. And so if he uses that as his basis for handling conflict situations, then he becomes ambulatory. He's just like anybody else. Or she is just like anybody else. And this is where the confusion comes in with bipolar people, is that they seem to be rational the majority of the time. It's only stress situations that they really blow up and will react either verbally or physically. And so that's where we get this idea that there are two types of personalities, or that something occurs later on in life, and so everybody goes chasing around looking, why did that guy blow up, or why did... why did that gunman shoot all those people? So they look at the present or early past, and they get very confused as to the why, they then start chasing around and saying, what could have happened in their past that would make them do this sort of thing, when you don't know how the brain is structured, the questions of why becomes infinite.
Well, can I ask you something?
Okay,
I wanted a bit of advice on a thought I had. You know how, like, sometimes a crazy person will do some crazy stuff to you, and you're like, you know what? I don't understand why they're doing that or anything like that. I don't understand how they think.
Right.
And my perspective on this, if a crazy person's doing something and you're trying to understand how they think, the only way that you're actually going to understand how they think is if you drive yourself crazy thinking about it.
Right, that's true. That's exactly right. Is that this is where you get in fact, interestingly enough, I think, I don't know if you... got the news down there, but a couple of weeks ago, Obama found another place that he could spend some money that he doesn't have in the area of mental health.
I'm sorry, we're coming to break here, and the idea of Obama spending money that he doesn't have on mental health to add to all the other giant list of things that he has that he's paying for that he doesn't have money for is pretty amusing to me. We'll be right back with Victor H. Fisher, ladies and gentlemen, just a few minutes.
I got some so-called friends, smile right to my face, all when my back is turned.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Dr. Victor H. Fisher. Victor, you were talking about how Obama has just decided to spend a whole bunch more money on something mental healthy.
Yeah, not mental healthy. He was going to map the human brain. Like they did with the genes, trying to map the human genome. And
why? So they can patent that too?
Pardon?
Why? So they can patent that too?
Well, there was a big article in New York Times. Well, there's a lot of articles about it, actually, I should say. But there is one that's in the New York Times that outlines what his thought was, what he wanted to do. And one of the first thing that he thought that mapping the human brain was going to lead to new information to cure epilepsy. And the ironic part about this whole, and this is, he was going to, just for the first year, in the 2014 budget year, which starts in October, is that he was going to spend $100 million on this mapping program. And it was acknowledged in the article, at least, that new technology, new instrumentation is going to be necessary to do this, because they're now acknowledging what they have already is not adequate in that area. But the irony about the whole thing is, in my case, this is that back in 1962, we completed the mapping of the human brain, and so it was and we also patented a new form of detecting brainwaves and brain activity. So what he is proposing to spend $100 million has already been done, but has been specifically suppressed for these past 50 years, because we were able to cure epilepsy back then, 50 years ago, and at a very, very low cost, and as compared to what's not being cured today. There is a major push by the pharmaceutical companies to never cure epilepsy, because
or anything, really.
Well, that's true. Their system is set up to only treat symptoms and not get cures. That's true.
Well, that
if you cure a
perpetual
patient,
you get a kind of perpetual customer, because
that's right.
You never
exactly
give them
right
the opportunity to catch fish for themselves, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I just wrote a two-pager, one page and a half, which talks specifically about this area of healthcare. And let me read it to you. Up to and about 50 to 60 years ago, the medical profession lived by their Hippocratic oath, which mainly states that they must not prescribe treatments that would do harm to their patients. After the cure of polio was discovered and applied in 1962, nearly all of the healthcare industry's income was significantly reduced. Therefore, thereafter, the Hippocratic Oath has been ignored, and a newer policy was established, quote, to treat the symptoms and not the cause, end quote. More cures have been suppressed because a healthy person is not paying a healthy person is not a paying consumer for healthcare goods or services. Most governments worldwide have assumed that the healthcare industries in their countries are still complying with the original Hippocratic Oath. Therefore, they have allowed the policies for healthcare to be self-controlled. As a result of this misconception, governments have been financially supporting many fraudulent research projects, fraudulent formal educational textbooks and study plans, licensing agreements, and clinical procedures. For a few of the current healthcare specialties are co-conspirators to the suppression, I should say, of the cures are listed as follows. The first is psychiatry. The Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, reported in 1962 a breakthrough research project, which later discovered the treatment for controlling and curing all forms of epilepsy within a three-month treatment period, using a very low-cost generic medicine. This discovery has been suppressed to this day, because its application would reduce the healthcare industry's total income by more than 50%, and that the majority of their patients would become healthy and happy. The second one is neurology. research projects stated above in the 1962 report by JAMA proved that the standard electroencephalograph, EEG, is not capable to record neurological activity within the human brain. Just within the last few months, brain imaging data was acquired at Harvard Center of Brain Science with their Siemens fMRI head scanner within the Department of Psychology at Harvard University in Cambridge. This data confirms that the current standard EEG continues to be misrepresented and is actually an electromyograph only records neurological activity of the subject's facial muscles, not brain, just the facial muscles. All reports obtained by the use of an interpretation of a standard EEG records must be considered as being fraudulent. Now, under psychology, within the last few weeks, there have been published reports from many different psychology departments at major American universities and one major Japanese university concerning the use of the functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI equipment to attempt to validate their very bizarre hypotheses to predict dreams and behavior. This is very apparent. It is very apparent that these researchers do not realize the risk of using fMRI head scanners for their fantasy research is a million times greater than any potential benefits. The human head MRI equipment was designed to be used for imaging the brain prior to brain surgery. The images show concentrations of blood. Usually blood concentrates where there are cancer tissue or tumors. The MRI acts like a microwave oven and starts cooking the cancer tissue. Since the brain surgeon is going to remove the cancer tissue, the risk of prior cooking is negated. When using MRI for pre-surgery information, the patient is blinded and is sensory deprived. And this is for don't get false images from mental activity. But using the MRI and with a healthy brain, which is what these researchers were doing, the subject is required to use their senses and thought processes. Their blood will concentrate in their thought processing locations, thereby will cook their thought neurons, cells, neural cells. This will cause deterioration of their intellect, and since the cooked nerve tissue is not removed, there is a high probability that the cooked tissue will decompose and become cancerous and cause premature death. Now, in general medicine, many patients will seek the help from general practitioners which have symptoms arising from an unknown cause, which is called idiopathic. Most of these patients can be classified as a psychomotor epileptic and will respond to the same treatment for the control and cure of a grand mal seizure epileptic. The reason that these two or more reason for that is two or more symptoms treatments are the same is that they all are responding to the same epileptic activating system, but in different brain locations. Once the attending doctor understands the neural physiology of the epileptic activating system, the diagnosis and treatment is very simple. Okay, that's the end. Any questions?
Well, you know, not some questions occur to me, just the general aspect of it. Have you noticed, Victor, that most things that you are widely promoted, usually within top fields, you know, whether it be politics or the medical industry or something of that nature, whatever their stated intention is and whatever this great machine is supposed to do, you can basically assume that it does the opposite while looking very fancy and being very expensive to operate. So somebody's getting rich and nobody else is getting healthy because of it.
Well, yeah, because here again, look at who's handling the purse strings to fund these this equipment and fund the hospitals and fund schools and pay off the doctors to prescribe their patent medicines and all this sort of thing. So, which are all antisocial, really.
Well, you make money off human suffering. It's the very epitome of antisocial behavior, is it not?
Well, yes. That's why it was all antisocial behavior. And you know, the managements, the top managements of these companies are highly predictable to be the psychopathic, you know, the retrospective with physical motivations.
I have that real very searing pain in my stomach whenever somebody talks about going to a lawyer or a doctor or they develop some kind of disease and they get told all these things that they should do and these machines that must work and these surgeries that you have to schedule and so on and so forth, waiting lists you have to go on. And I think to myself, you know, I think that's a whole lot of BS. When you don't understand what's going on, and... if you're in a hospital, trust me, unless the doctor's sitting there telling you step by step absolutely everything that's going on and everything they've learned, which they won't, you have no idea.
Right.
And if you're in a situation where you have no idea what's going on, imagine how much easier it is to convince you of things that aren't true, considering you've got no point of reference.
Yeah. No, in fact, there's a very interesting movie that I discovered just a couple weeks ago. The title is Fight for Life. F-I-G-H-T for Life, L-I-F-E. And it is a documentary that Jerry Lewis and Patty Duke play the leads in this movie. And it's about a... 6-year-old child, adopted child of the characters, and she became an epileptic, she initially, her first seizure was when she had a high fever, 103 fever. But they immediately, you know, went down to the neurologist, the leading neurologist, I guess. And the most interesting part, from my vantage point, is that this movie was based on an actual case.
Victor, unfortunately, we're coming to break. Let's talk about the actual case when we come back. Victor H. Fisher is my guest, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Back in a minute. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Victor H. Fisher. Victor, what were you talking about before? There was a real life example of some kind of medical
treatment. Epileptic child. And it was the title of the movie is Fight, F-I-G-H-T, for Life, L-I-F-E. And it was recorded for DVD in 1987. But the actual event, which was the basis of this movie, actually occurred in 1977, and well, 77 and 78, actually, in those two years. And the irony about this particular movie and this particular event, it was that it occurred in the city of Columbus, Ohio, and the only relief that was offered to the father, played by Jerry Lewis, was to take his daughter to England for a treatment for epilepsy in England, because it was suppressed in the United States, and by obviously the pharmaceuticals. And so the part of that coincidence is that my research, which I conducted as a senior scientist at Battelle Memorial Institute, was located in Columbus, Ohio, and it was tested. The equipment was tested at the Columbus State Hospital, which was the largest mental health hospital in the state of Ohio, and that was in 1962, I should say. And was reported in the Journal of American Medical Association in 1962, which verified the validity of the my research, and they illustrated that this was a breakthrough technology that. Proved, well, that was my initial proof that the standard EEG was a fraud. And so 17 years, I'm sorry, less than that, 77 and 62, is only 15 years. 15 years later, it got my breakthrough technology, which was also stated by Dr. Haynes, which was the director of mental health for the state of Ohio, as being breakthrough technology and will improve humanity. And 15 years later, in the same city, just miles apart, there's the most prominent neurologist. Ignored my research.
This is the institution. I find it very funny how they call it mental health when their approach to health is pretty mental. Kind of like how the criminal justice system approaches justice in a criminal way.
In a criminal way, that's right. So it's going to be interesting to see what's Obama. I don't think that it's. I don't even think that he's going to be there in for the next fiscal year, anyways. But that's another story. But the
Do you know something that we don't?
Well, I think that basically the. From an economic point of view, the corporation, the United States corporation, is insolvent and bankrupt. So it can't print money out of thin air anymore. So if you're bankrupt,
I don't know about that.
Huh?
I don't know about that. they can print as much money out of thin air as they want because they're printing it out of thin air.
Yeah, but see, the unfortunate part about money, it's a psychological phenomena. You get a piece of paper, a piece of Monopoly dollar, and you put a value on that piece of paper psychologically. And when people will stop saying that this is just Monopoly money and it has no value because it has no backing, because they're all of Federal Reserve notes are debt instruments, there's nobody going to be paying, where are you going to get the money to pay the debt?
Somebody once handed me a $50 note that had the words "This is your God" written on it.
Well,
that's all money is a belief system,
right? But see, that's the point is that like China right now has 40% of the countries that are productive. Well, they got actually 100% of the countries that are productive, but which represents 40% of the GDP in the world, and they're swapping currency without going through buying dollars, which has been the so-called reserve currency for since 1913.
I think it's more like being the perverse currency.
So, if nobody is accepting your dollars, where can you pay your payroll? Where can you buy equipment? For your military or Social Security or anything else.
Well, presumably they'd come up with some kind of new central banker-controlled global currency that nobody can escape from, you know.
Well, that's a myth. There is not going sustainable. See, what you're saying is they're going to expand the euro, which is a.
Oh yeah. Well, thing is, I'm not saying that they're doing it based upon a rational thing like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to have the American dollar, American continent dollar, like the Amero or whatever. And, there'd basically just be a currency regulation market where the central bankers just control everybody's value of currency. And they just play, move them. It's like musical chairs monopoly, essentially. And you'll give all power to the bankers. Well, that's why I think currencies are going to be regulated in the future by ruthless criminal sociopaths who have total control over it and make it up off the top of their head at the same time.
Well, see, that is what's caused the problem with the euro. The bankers are controlling the euro. That's what's causing problems with the United States, with the bankers controlling the dollar. That's what's causing all of the problems that is using what we call fiat or government issued money, what the Chinese is doing is they're saying that they will accept a ruble from Russia and whatever the other countries' currencies are, and those other countries will accept the Chinese yuan. And they are bypassing the whole banking system that was set up around the Federal Reserve System. So that.
Mm. Well, aren't the Chinese artificially suppressing the value of the yuan as well?
Oh no. The yuan, in China we call it the RMB, the people's money, it's printed the yuan, which is the Chinese version of the yen for Japan. The symbol is the same symbol for yuan and yen, but And that's why we internally talk about RMBs and not beyonds. The symbolic, it's a translation. The Chinese translation of yen is yuan. But they're two separate, obviously have two separate central banks. The central bank in China is called the People's Bank of China, and it is also the Treasury of China. But it is independent, totally independent. But see, the top four banks, as far as profitability is concerned, in the whole world, are Chinese banks. The highest, the top one, number one is the ICBC, is the initials for the top one. To show the difference between the Chinese banking system as compared to, even New Zealand, the Chinese banks are required to maintain 20% of their deposits as reserve money.
As opposed to 10% in the West. Hey, Victor, unfortunately, we were running out of time for this hour. You're not able to join us for the second hour, are you?
Well, yeah, I can go one more hour.
All right. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, in just a few minutes for another hour with the fabulous and wonderful and always insightful Victor H. Fisher. Back in a minute.
Particles funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation to fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
Welcome. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live the lighter side of genocide 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, for your listening pleasure. In need of donations and subscriptions, we are all slaves to money, no matter even if it's made up, you still need it to survive. Isn't that interesting? So if you'd like to subscribe to the Vinnie Eastwood Show and give some of your slave money to this cause of giving interesting people a little bit of a platform to talk about their interesting stuff, then you can go to the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com for as little as $1 a month. We will give you commercial free Vinnie Eastwood Show archives. Saves an awful lot of listening time and really contributes to the flow of the programs and the discussions that we have on here sometimes. My very special guest is Victor H. Fisher, and you were talking about the relationship between the Japanese and the Chinese economies. Do you believe that these banking systems that the Chinese are instituting now, you know, with the People's Bank and all of that, do you think that that's really going to shift the kind of grandiose global agenda of the private bankers?
Yes, no two ways about it. The bottom line is that there's an old adage, a thousand-year-old adage, he who has the has the gold writes the rules. And United States is still claiming that they have 8,000 tons of gold that is under their control, sitting there in various locations like West Point and Fort Knox and those kinds of things, areas underneath the Bank of Federal Reserve Bank of New York. There's a big a deposit of bullion there, but virtually 100% or more. In fact, my sense is that there's more gold that is well, as far as bullion is concerned, that's 100% is actually owned by other countries or other people. We're just storing the gold, and I think that leadership for the last at least 20 years has sold gold certificates which are not backed by any gold. So we're in my sense is that we're in a negative. If everybody makes claim to their gold in the States, they're not going to get it.
Unless the dude actually has the coin or the bar in his frickin' hand, he doesn't have any gold.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, unfortunately, that's the situation now with gold. And silver's in the same boat, really.
Hold on a second. That means that they're in the global gold market and ostensibly the silver market too. There's a lot of gold and silver missing. I wonder how much fake gold is out there that doesn't really exist and how much is it being used to prop up the market, maybe force up the price of gold or something like that, like keeping it artificially low?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'll give you a perfect example. Last Friday, the Federal Reserve System bought... Well, they didn't really even buy it. It's called a naked short, which means that you don't put up any front money. 500 tons of gold futures, and they shorted it. So that 500 tons is just paper that affected the market, and it dropped 5% in within one day, the market, the price of gold.
Whoa.
Wow. 500 tons.
That 500 tons of gold doesn't exist?
Doesn't exist. No.
And are they talking about just 500 tons of gold, or are they talking that paper represents, or have they actually got 500 tons of paper worth of gold receipts?
For all practical purposes, it could be that 500 tons of paper.
it's volumetric currency wars. I love it.
Yeah. So, you know, this is, in fact, that gives you a good indication how much paper, well, how susceptible the market is. But at the same time, interestingly enough, just within a few days, just this past week or so, China bought 100 tons of gold and of gold bullion of the real stuff. So they've increased their gold holdings. Last year they increased it by 800 tons. And this year it'll be well over 1,000 tons that they'll increase their stockpile. But see, just look at what they have to work with. The United States currency, they are holding $3,000 as a creditor to... to the debtor of the United States, Federal Reserve and Treasury. So
you just said $3,000. Are you sure you didn't miss out like a couple of zeros?
I'm sorry, I'm off by a few thousand. $3 trillion.
So the Chinese are holding $3 trillion that they could pretty much either pull or dump or do something with at any point and completely collapse the U.S. economy.
They're dumping a lot of it into gold and silver, and they're also buying up a whole bunch of projects like in Africa and stuff like that. So they're not holding very many Most of that $3 trillion has already been, for all practical purposes, been spent.
Well, when we're talking about this massive amount of paper fake gold that exists, what occurred to me is somebody must be taking the real stuff and hoarding it because they know that all this other stuff is fake. Who are those people?
And that's what I was just saying, that both China, Russia, India, India and China are about equal in acquiring gold as far as buying gold is concerned. China actually got bigger. Is now the main source of mined gold. South Africa used to be the leader in mining gold, but China now is a leader as far as the world is concerned. But they've never sold. China has never sold 1 ounce of mined gold. They're just hoarding it, and that's a figure that is not fully made public. Put it that way.
And what are they doing with all this gold? Are they giving it to some kind of dragon that like has it in a giant nest or lair or something like that?
Well, they're obviously have. They're in locked up facilities. The new airport in Hong Kong that was built just a few years ago is underneath it. The airport are a big warehouse for gold. Absorbed. Hong Kong, and for very good reasons. It is a financial capital of banks and financial houses like Bear Stearns and these other guys, Goldman Sachs. They have outlets there in Hong Kong. So it's Hong Kong is a good source, as a alternate purchaser of gold. So the mainland will buy gold independent of Hong Kong, and then they transfer the Hong Kong gold over to the mainland. China owns a large number. A few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, obtained a number of 250 major banks around the world, and so public banks, and so they are, and some very very large banks, those. Are good sources for buying gold on behalf of China. So basically, my sense is that China's set up sort of interesting from an organizational point of view. The propaganda about China is that the Communist Party rules China. Well, the Communist Party, by name, is the administrator of the government of China. But the Chinese economy is certainly not a communist economy. The Chinese like to call it a socialist with Chinese characteristics, and what that sort of means that it's sort of a hybrid type of organization. Under a true communist like Russia and China, when Mao was in control, a true communist means that the government owns all enterprises, all companies are owned by the government and are controlled, planning and controlled by the government. So when you live in a true communist country, you work for the government, no matter what. If you're alive, you work for the government, or else you have to be as self-employed, entrepreneurial type individual or family. I just saw a few months ago, there are 40,000 registered companies in China, and 250 of them are called state-owned enterprises. So the government is now, these are the big companies, like railroads and utilities and coal and oil and things like that. But they only own and control. But see, here in China, also, as contrasted to Mao or Stalin, communism, all of the state-owned companies, number one, they have to pay taxes, and number two, they have to pay dividends to the government. So the state-owned operations have to be competitive.
It sounds very much like a trust
worldwide, and so that they have to make a profit. So Chinese are very profit sensitive, profit oriented, profit operation. Now we just had a change in government now. As of now, March, beginning of March, and that new government was appointed by theoretically, what's printed is that it was nominated and elected by the People's Party, the National People's Party, and of China, which is designated as NPC, and that group is just a few people shy of 3,000 members, and that's their Congress. And that group the propaganda on that group is that it's a rubber stamp, and it's just for show, but in reality, it is not any more rubber stamped than our Congresses, especially the Democratic Party. So it's sort of silly to say that 3,000 people that are elected locally are just a rubber stamp operation that the leadership is involved with controlling everything. Now, there is another major organization that is almost on the same level as the NPC, the Congress, and that is has a designation of CPPCC. And it is a consulting think tank, and that group is—I forget how many people are involved with it. It's fairly large number. It's in the thousands, we'll put it that way. But these are all—it's broken up into, I think, like nine subdivisions, and they're parallel to the ministerial level of the Congress.
Well, hold on a second there, man, because when you said it was just a rubber stamp organization, I said, what? Aren't all governments supposed to be? What else are they there for? We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, 5 days a week for your listening and brain juice flowing, eargasm pleasure with my very special guest, Victor H. Fisher. Yeah, well, I actually managed to rhyme that one. How interesting. Victor, you were talking about China and trying to give the insider's perspective on what's actually really going on in the country. Is it just me being cynical to say it matters not the perks of the Chinese economy or the American economy or any of them, because underneath it all, they're still predicated by scumbaggery?
No, not in China. Now, during that the 10 years or so, I don't know what his full tenure was, Mao, it tried to westernize, in a sense, itself, and thinking that the West, had better governments and things like that. And that's, to a large extent, the reason why Mao selected communism, was that was a Western system of control and organization of a government. But as we history now has recorded, it was a disaster. And there's a... And that's what happened with communism in Russia, is that it turned out to be a disaster, too. And so what Putin operation is a non-communist organization system. And in China, it had been a imperial organization for thousands of years, warlords or imperial. But see, the problem that imperial and warlords have is that their armies could never be big enough to control the whole country. And when I first came to China back in 1987, I was told by a Chinese, obviously, that China has never been conquered, and he included by its own leadership, because there was never any leader that was able to control all of his citizens, because there were just too many, and the country is too large. So, ended up is that the citizens had to become self-sufficient and had to earn their own money and their what they did is they set up a family system, and that the family it was an independently employed company, you might call it, or venture or enterprise, and then they have what they call or is called an extended family, which means that they will only interact with individuals that they would consider as being a personal friend, because here again they were always concerned on a defensive basis as to protection against various warlords or bandits coming into their villages. And so that was their security was through this this attitude of extended families. But the Chinese, through the 5,000 years of, or 7,000 years, some of the people are saying had to be for own survival, had to become self-sufficient, and so they're very the average citizen here is very apolitical. They really don't pay much attention to the government, except
it's the same here.
I'm sorry?
It's the same here in New Zealand.
The same thing?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good.
Except everybody kind of lives in a perpetual cycle of just working to survive, and they don't care about politics. They just go out drinking every weekend and try to get the nicer way. I mean, basically, we're getting into the decadent part of an empire just before it kind of crumbles and collapses, when everybody kind of gets lazy and stops caring about things that matter and makes celebrities out of chefs and superstars out of people that race chariots.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, here again, New Zealand is a very young country as far as modern, you know, the Anglo-Saxon invasion, and so we're all just a very few generations were from people that were exploring, and by definition we're very prospective. And self-supporting. But to get back to China...
Yeah, I was just going to say there's a cultural thing called the number eight wire mentality, because there's this particular thickness of wire, you know, where you can bend it round, and you can fix a whole lot of stuff with that. You know, you got a broken tractor or something like that. Back in the day, early colonial New Zealand, you'd be waiting 6 months for a tractor part.
Right. Oh, sure.
So you got to learn how to fix it yourself, and that's kind of what's called the number eight wire mentality. Kiwis are famous for it. Just coming up with some invention to make a thing. You know, world's fastest Indian, what have you. Bunch of creative people, entrepreneurs, explorers, people who push the limits, climbed Everest first. You know.
No, it's that kind of mentality that is going to survive.
What I'm saying, Victor, is that those things happened like 100 years ago, and they no longer exist.
Well, that's true, and unfortunately, in China, it's dwindling away. In fact, the second law of thermodynamics is that you always go from order to disorder automatically. Chaos is the ultimate end goal of all order, all things that are ordered. And so if you don't continually put in controls and to put in new information, that you will end up chaotic. And that's what's going. We're seeing that right now in China. The younger generation is not following the tradition of thousands of years of traditional behavior. And in fact, on television, you almost just scanning through the multiple channels of television, which are, you know, like 30 or 20, or at least 30 or 40 channels. There's only one or two in English, but so I don't watch television very much. In fact, almost nothing. But here, but the there's at least two or three programs being aired simultaneously that are historical events, historical behavior. Let's get back to the economy again and the government. About 400 years ago, the Chinese innovations were discovered, and one of the major innovations was silk, and then China ware, I should say, plates and pottery and things like that. And then they had all these ceramics. And then they also had a large number of spices and then herbs like tea was discovered here being grown, you know, for thousands of years. And so the people back east said realized that this was a good source of new products that were specifically made here in the east and in China, and so they had the so-called silk route for caravans taking all of these various goods from China to Europe. And in Europe, they had fiat money at that time also, and they had gold. And the Chinese, in their wisdom, would not trade with anybody in the East by using their currency. They would only accept gold as payment. And so it was lots of very expensive and highly valued products going west and gold going east and on the return trip. So that gold was hoarded, obviously, by the not only the some of the people, but also some of the government, the emperors and warlords. So
well, the Chinese... I'm aware that the Chinese are really great hoarders. In fact, what was there was a number of people like bury bags of cash and things like that, and very kind of industrious at hiding their wealth and then keeping it for like their grandchildren and things like that. But unfortunately, right. Sometimes the mold gets in and it destroys the currency, which I don't think would happen with gold.
No, they'll see the purchasing power of gold hasn't changed in over 2,000 years. A Roman coin that in at Jesus' time was worth one coin, 1 ounce, which is one ounce of gold. That bought a very well-made, tailored cloak, a pair of sandals, and a belt, and they just for that one coin. Now today, 1 ounce is worth well, it's about $15,000 an ounce.
And, no, $1,500, $2,000.
Yeah. I'm sorry, $1,500. I'm sorry, got the decimal place pushed. Yeah, $1,500, and that'll buy you a nice suit, a nice belt, and a nice pair of shoes. So the purchasing power has not changed in 2,000 years.
Yeah, it makes it a good store of wealth, don't you think? Which means
that when
the price fluctuates, it has nothing to do with what the gold's doing. It has to do with what the currencies that are trying to buy the gold are doing to themselves, devaluing themselves.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, you know, the purchasing power of the gold is exactly stays constant. The only thing that causes the fluctuation is the normal methods of manipulation, which we were talking about earlier. You know, buying paper gold.
So one who is inextricably flush with gold, as the Chinese are, don't really have to worry about any kind of economic crisis because they can back up all of their debts.
Pardon?
Because they can back their own currency.
Sure. Right. In fact, my bank account, I have two bank accounts. One is an ICBC and the other one is a Bank of China, which is a subsidiary of the People's Bank of China. And I have a gold and silver account in ICBC, which I can buy and sell gold, convert yuan into gold or yuan into silver, and then reverse from the bullion the silver back into yuan again at spot prices. Right now, most of my investment is in silver, and it is. Been deflated because of all these naked shorts, the manipulation. But it's given me, in fact, I just bought some more silver just a couple days ago because it's been deflated so much. And that's what China's doing too, is the fools in America. Oops.
Yeah. Well, the fools in America are not doing what the Chinese are doing. And that's why the Chinese economy is growing at an intense and rapid rate, similar to the years after the revolution in the United States, incidentally. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Just in time, head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. This all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I'm no Superman, but laser beams do shoot out of my eyes. If I ever see David Rockefeller walking around my country, you boy, you better watch out. A very special guest is Victor H. Fisher. Are you live from the People's Republic of China by chance?
Yes. I've been here for 4 years. Well, four plus.
Would you describe your demeanor as a Chinese nationalist, incidentally?
When you say Chinese nationalist, you just talked about Chinese citizens?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they're very, very open. Very helpful, very friendly. The cost of living here is, you know, from a point of view of housing and food and travel, things like that, is concerned. It's about one-third the level it is in America. And so it's very pleasant. I'm in a condominium that I'm renting, and it's a four-bedroom condominium, and there's three people here, the condominium itself cost me about $2,000. That's 2,000 RMB a month. Divide that by 6.2. So it's pretty cheap, around $300 a month.
Whoa. This is opposed to like a week, you know, to rent like a shoebox.
all of my utilities for water, gas, electricity, groundskeeping and things like that cost me around 700 RMB, which is a little over $100.
Got a sweet deal, man. Leaves a lot more spare money lying around for investing in gold and silver then, eh?
That's right. Even with my very, very low Social Security income.
Now, isn't that funny? How exactly did Social Security come into effect?
Well, in the States?
Yeah.
In the United States? It started out as the widow's fund for black lung disease for coal miners. And then after 1 year, it was converted over to becoming Social Security. But it was designed initially by a union leader of the coal miners. Walt Reuther, I think was his name, and he was able to lobby Roosevelt to try to take care of the widows, because the coal miners lived in company housing and bought their food and provisions from company stores, and so they were pretty much just slave laborers. And when the income generator, the father or whoever's the income generator dies, the remaining family is destitute and literally just thrown out into the streets.
Sad stuff.
Bad stuff, right. But that was the genesis. But then... it's a Ponzi scheme. It's supposed to the people that we're working that they should pay into a fund, and it was claimed initially as being a sort of an insurance trust, but more recently the politicians in their glee to buy votes have been robbing that trust, and so now it's getting losing its trustfulness, but hopefully that's going to change when we convert into a collateral based dollar instead of a debt based dollar.
Can I ask you then, what do you think the new world having this basically hollowed out destruction or collapse of the U.S. economy and hence U.S. power around the world, and probably Europe will follow it into the pit, what kind of new structure do you think would be imposed on the world by those who have the remaining money?
Well, it's as far as currency is concerned, my vision, and based on fairly substantial investigation, is that we're going to be reintroducing Bretton Woods' scheme for currency, which was a collateral, it was a gold-based system. But at that time, in 1947, the United States had 20,000 tons of gold, and they claim to have 8,000 now. But as I said earlier, I think that they have zero, a negative amount of bullion. So the United States is in real bad problem. There's a high probability that there's going to be a major deflation. Depreciation. Of the value of the gold, of the Treasury dollar, and compared to the Federal Reserve dollar, because there's too many contracts out there using the word dollar included in it, and many countries have used the dollar as their basis for their currency. So they the name is going to stay the same, but the value is going to be very much changed. In the Bretton Woods setup, each country had a choice of the currency, type of currency that they were going to have. And the value of that, the purchasing power of that currency is going to be calculated and established so that exchange rates will be semi-frozen. And what I mean by semi-frozen, if the political politicians in any country wants to inflate the value of their gold, I mean, their currency, then they, by definition, they're going to deflate the purchasing power. And that'll be done on a continuous analysis of all of the different currencies in the nearly 200 countries in the world. But it'll be this business of having to buy dollars just to purchase foreign goods, that'll be totally removed.
Well, Victor, we've only got a minute or two left in the broadcast. I think we should probably reserve this for you plugging your books and so forth, because you do need more money to buy gold, don't you?
That's for sure. Well, my book is you caught me when I closed up, but it's Improvement of Your Thought Process. I think that's the name. And it's a Kindle book. The way you can get it is go to a Kindle store, and just use in the selection at the just say Victor Fisher Psychology, if you want. That's VictorFisher, and then psychology, and there's others involved. Thought will be as another keyword, and then I'll take you to the page for the purchase of the book. So it's a Kindle book, describes my research back in 62, 63, and it also, I have a series of publications, one from the Journal of American Medical Association back in 62, April in 62, which verified that my research on the Heifrig and the patent on the Heifrig is okay.
You can finish your sentence. Got about 20 seconds.
No, that's okay.
It's okay. Something about the Heifrig cliffhanger, ladies and gentlemen. You'll have to wait until he comes on next time.
Okay.
All right. And also Google Victor H. Fisher. I Googled that the other day, and there's an awful lot of work that this guy has done. And in fact, I've had him on the show a number of times. Really, really interesting interviews if you want to understand the human mind. And this is the first time we've gotten to talk economy. And that was very enlightening too. Victor, thank you very much for your time.
All right, please.
Yeah, indeed we do. We'll see you again sometime. And you too, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening.